Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
Here we are once again at Philosopher's Corner, a shady oasis on the campus of Stanford University. And through the good graces of radio station KALW in San Francisco, you're invited to join us, too.
You can always join us anytime on the World Wide Web at philosophytalk.org. So what's our topic this week, John?
Genes, genetics, clones, and other people.
Oh, that's really cool stuff. His stem cell research and all that stuff. You know, I'm just wildly enthusiastic about this thing. I think if you know you could have the stem cell research, it's not only going to cure these diseases, but you could make hearts to replace your own heart when you get old and decrepit. It's just great. And genetic engineering, you can tune your children's brains so that they're the smartest people in the world. It's just super. So what's the philosophical issue?
You're such an enthusiast,
I am.
Ken. I mean, it's full of philosophical problems and thickets and moral dilemmas. As far as I'm concerned, they should just put the whole thing off for a couple hundred years until we can figure out what to do with it. As far as I'm concerned, the National Institutes of Health ought to be renamed the National Institute for Figuring Out Things That We Don't Know What to Do About Ethically.
Oh, man, you're such a curmudgeon. I mean, but help me think about this more. I don't quite see what you think is the ethical problem. Are you worried about, you know, abortion or something like that?
Well, it's related to that. I mean, take what you call harvesting stem cells. That means producing human life for some purpose like helping someone like you not have as many aches and pains or have a longer life. Now, that may be a pretty good purpose, but you're a Kantian. I mean, you admire Kant. He said you should not produce human life to be a means, it should be an end in itself. So doesn't that bother you?
Well, yeah, it would bother me if I thought we were doing that. But, you know, the stem cell research, let's just take that example. That's it starts with these blastocysts. That's a clump of cells, 100 cells or so, that haven't differentiated yet and can go any direction. And, you know, it could become a pair of identical twins, triplets, quadruplets. Or if we learn how to intervene, we could make one turn into a heart. So big deal. I mean, it's not yet a person. It's not yet, you know.
I was going to point out that it was a potential person, and you've pointed out that it's potentially two or three people. That's a big comfort. Ken, I mean, somehow, maybe we went to different graduate schools. Maybe I missed out on the course where they explain where human life and personhood and rights and obligations begin. But I missed it. It's good to know that you're so sure about it.
Well, I'm not saying I'm sure about it, but I just think the potential of this thing is tremendous, and I don't want to wait 100 years. What about all those people who would die from Parkinson's and diabetes if we just shut this off? I mean, don't we have more of an obligation to those actual people than the mere potential people who might be born? You know, it just doesn't seem right to me.
Well, potential people is one thing, but the question is, where does potentiality end and human life begin? How about cloning? I suppose you're enthusiastic about that, too.
Well, I am, and I don't think it raises very murky issues. We'll probably get into that with our guests. I want to stress that what I think are the benefits of this, all the stuff we could do with it, and I just don't want to cut that off.
I'll have to admit it's very, very tempting on the other side. There are great promises for cloning and stem cell research. In giving us the possibility to cure some terrible diseases, our own roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, actually begins her weekly audio essay by taking us to a place where cures would be most welcome.
This is the waiting room of UC San Francisco's pediatric care department, which specializes in the treatment of type 1 diabetes in children.
Stay right there, because I think we're next. If you look at the consequences of diabetes over the long haul, it's frightening. Traditionally, people with diabetes have had a lifespan that's been shortened by as much as 10 to 20 years. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness in adults. It's the leading cause of kidney failure, increased risk for amputation of a limb.
Dr. Stephen Gittleman, director of the Children's Diabetes Clinic here, counsels patients on their onerous daily regimen of insulin injections and blood sugar monitoring. But what he'd really like to see is a cure.
The real hope for the future is stem cells. And stem cells have a unique regenerative capacity. So they're early in the developmental state, and they can be coaxed to become beta cells.
Insulin-producing beta cells could allow a body to start producing its own insulin again, curing the patient of diabetes. There are several practical issues to solve before this will work. Among them, where do you get all those stem cells? One way would be to clone human embryos, as a team of Korean scientists did in February. These clones would provide a huge supply of stem cells with all kinds of medical potential. But in order to get a stem cell, you've got to destroy the embryo, which, some argue, is a living being in its own right.
This early, early embryo created is also in the continuity of life. So what would be the reason for why this wouldn't also have inviolability or moral standing?
Bill Hurlbut is a member of the President's Council on Bioethics, which recommended a moratorium on cloning for biomedical research. Hurlbut says there's more to the cloning debate than just the pro-life, pro-choice question. He objects to what he calls an instrumental view of human life.
In other words, what's troublesome here to most people is that there's the intentional creation of a life in order to use it as a mere resource. We don't, at any other stage of life, favor an instrumental use of human beings. Even in the case where a criminal is being executed, we have laws against the use of that criminal's organs for transplantation. We want to keep way distant from the notion that our system of justice would in any way be clouded by a utilitarian purpose.
But what about Dr. Gittleman, who works daily with children suffering from diabetes? Would he support the cloning of embryos for stem cells?
Personally, I would support it. Knowing what I know and seeing the suffering and cost to society of the impact of diabetes on people's lives.
The implication there is that the child in front of you is the only life in question. Now, if one is going to make such an assertion, one needs to come up with a justification for why the embryo in the dish does not have a moral standing commensurable with the child you wish to cure.
It's hard to imagine a more difficult set of philosophical questions. Is an early embryo human life? And if it is it ethical to create embryos for the sole purpose of harvesting their stem cells? Is one life ever more valuable than another? This is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Amy. Those seem to be the key questions in the debate over cloning and stem cell research. And to help us tackle these questions, we're joined in the studio today by our colleague Hank Greeley.
Yeah, our distinguished colleague Hank Greeley. Hank is the author of Cloning Californians, a former clerk for Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart. He is also chair of the steering committee for the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics. Hank, welcome to Philosophy Talks.
Thank you.
So help me think about the moral status of a cluster of stem cells, as I like to put it. Are we really on morally shaky ground and mucking around with embryos?
Well, you know, I'm a law professor, and asking a lawyer about morality is a little odd, but I think there are a lot of moral questions. People have very different views. Those views, I think, come down to different concerns about or different beliefs about the moral status of a human embryo. Now, if it's just a cluster of stem cells in a petri dish, that's a different issue, but the embryo itself does have the potential to become a person like any of the three of us. Its potential, though, can only be realized if it successfully implants and goes to term inside a woman's womb. I think one of the most interesting things about this whole debate is that somewhere between 50 to 80% of all fertilized eggs never establish pregnancies. So there are a lot of embryos that are wasted naturally. And that, I think, puts a slightly different spin on how significant or how human a thing that small ball of cells is.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. It's kind of the consistency of our society, if we should decide that stem cell research was bad, but continue to produce embryos for this other purpose. But since this is Philosophy Talk, we're supposed to plunge in where most people just kick the issue over to religious leaders or dead philosophers. So let's really think about this. On the one hand, at one extreme, we might have a petri dish full of stem cells. At the other end, let's say we have a 2 or 3 year old, a person with some ability to think, plan, have ambitions, desires, and so forth. I think we'd agree that by age 2, you've definitely got a person. Maybe not a full developed autonomous person, but somebody who's shouldn't be treated totally as a thing. As a thing, right? And then a lot of people would say, well, at this other extreme, we'd need an argument that that's a person. Is there somewhere in between where it's natural to draw a line, or is the whole idea of looking for a place to draw a line a mistake?
That's a tough question. People do draw lines. The Catholic Church draws the line at fertilization. There are scientists and the government of the United Kingdom who suggest a line at the development of the primitive streak. That happens at 12 to 14 days into embryonic development, when the inner cell mass, the part that becomes the fetus and ultimately us, first begins to show signs of differentiating into different kinds of cells. Some of the cells of the primitive streak go on to become the brain and the nerve tissue. I personally think that you're on a continuum where any sharp line is going to be debatable.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the drawing the line, for example, at fertilization, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, just because, take the issue that Hank mentioned in passing, all the embryos that just never make it, right? All that never get implanted and are washed out in the, as women think they just had a late period or something, but some embryos just been washed out. And then fertilization, we now know, is this really complicated process, you know. And for a while, look, if we don't intervene with the human intervention, certain things might happen, right? But and we can intervene to make different things happen. I don't quite see why human intervention is such a bad thing, especially when what you've got is a clump of cells to begin with, undifferentiated, and that will eventually differentiate if we don't intervene. But what's to stop us from intervening to stop that?
So Ken, I won't ask you to draw a sharp line, but just what do you think of the line that our Supreme Court, that beacon of moral wisdom, not the current one, has drawn in Roe v. Wade? That is basically after the second trimester, it's really considered pretty morally chancy to interfere with a pregnancy. Do you think that's a clear place where we've got a person that shouldn't be treated as a means and not an end?
I mean, I think, and I'd like to know what our lawyer thinks about this too, but I think that, sure, there's a point at which you begin to think, well, this thing is developed enough and its potential clear enough that it gets to have some kind of standing. I don't want to claim that a fetus, for example, has the moral standing of, I don't know, of just anything, of a booger in your nose or something like that. I don't want to claim that. But it's got less than the moral standing of a full person, somewhere in between. I don't know. Hang
on. And I think the lawyer's perspective is there are a lot of places where you've got to have lines.
Mm-hmm.
And the lines sometimes are somewhat arbitrary. The line between when it's daylight and when it's nighttime is an arbitrary line in the middle of a gradually darkening sky. I think the viability line that the Supreme Court drew in Roe v. Wade makes some sense. It's as defensible a line as any other, and often we have to go with lines that aren't perfect, but we can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good.
Yeah, I think that's a nice point. I mean, I think we draw the line. It's not dictated to us by biology or something. We draw it. We decide.
Of course, as a philosopher, I'm not sure about anything, not that I have a hand in front of my face or that you two are even real. But still,
we feel the same.
There's a sense that, look, and we may have to take this up after the break, but let me just make the point. Night and day, that is by nature a continuum. But if we think as philosophers and religious leaders for thousands of years have thought that there is such a thing as a soul that brings with it consciousness and thought and human rights, then the problem isn't that we have a by nature continuum, but we're just ignorant of when that happens. The Catholic Church has one opinion, the Supreme Court another. But ignorance is not the same as knowledge.
In a bit, we'll take your phone calls and we'll continue with the question John raised. Here's our question to you, our audience. What's so scary about genetic research? Lots of people are scared. Are you? Is it right to harvest stem cells to cure disease? Is it all right to genetically design your own children?
We invite you to join our discussion. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment, and we may read your comment on the air and ask Hank Greeley about it.
Philosophy Talk continues after this short break.
Thomas Dolby and She Blinded Me with Science. In this case, the science that promises to cure diseases by harvesting stem cells, and the science that allows us to think about engineering our genes and changing the very nature of human life. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. And our guest today is Hank Greeley from Stanford University. We'd like you to join our conversation. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or if you're near your computer, go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on that comments button up on the upper right-hand corner there and send us a comment. We might read your question on the air.
Here are our questions. What's so scary about genetic research? Is it right to harvest stem cells to cure disease? Should people be allowed to genetically design their children?
Hank, you were saying you wanted to come back to a point that John had made, I thought.
Yeah, and John was talking about ensoulment, and I agree with John that that's potentially a crucial issue.
But ensoulment, let's make sure that that's the installing of a soul.
Right, yeah. When a soul comes into right. the entity that will later become a person. And I think there are two important points to make about that. The first is the idea that there is a moment of ensoulment is from a scientific perspective is a hypothesis, and one without a lot of evidence to support it. There's nothing
obvious.
I'm glad
you said that.
There's nothing obvious that shows us that there's a moment when the embryo changes and that involves ensoulment as opposed to a developmental continuum. But I think the second most interesting, the more interesting point is even if you assume there is a moment of ensoulment, fertilization seems like an odd moment to do it, both because 50 to 80% of fertilized eggs never become fetuses. So if they're all in the afterlife is an odd place where 80% of the souls there have never lived. And secondly, people, as Ken pointed out, can become twins, triplets, quadruplets. When does the extra soul come in if there's only one fertilized egg? So I agree with you that ensoulment's important. But it's not a slam dunk of an issue.
Hank, that's a good discussion. It's a shame you settled for law. You could have gone on and become a philosopher.
Had a really honest profession. I'm going to raise a slightly different issue, and then I think we should let some callers in here. But I'm going to a slightly different issue. People get worried about genetic engineering. You know, we haven't talked much about manipulating the children of your genes to perfect them. But, you know, we send our children to the best schools to perfect them. We read to them in the crib. We do all this stuff. I mean, a person is partly genetically determined and partly environmentally determined. We manipulate the environment out the wazoo. Why can't we do the same? John, you're so squeamish about some of this stuff. At least you sounded at some point. Why can't we do the same thing?
I'm not squeamish about anything, but I represent the fact that, like most philosophical issues, we really are clueless here. But here, you sound a little to me like Garrison Keillor, right? Let's have a world in which all the children are above average. They're all as good-looking as you and as smart as me and as funny as Hank.
Yeah, now, right.
Is that really possible?
I don't know. Hank, what do you think?
Would it be a bad thing if it were? I mean, I think Ken's got a really good point here. I'm a parent, and it's not only do I try to enhance my kids, it's my duty to do so. I'm a bad parent if I don't. Now, I think this is going to be an academic discussion for quite a while because, frankly, we don't know very much that would lead us to be able to genetically enhance our kids.
But
the connections right now between genes and the things we care most about, intelligence, personality, other sorts of skills, are very weak and very little known and may never turn out to be well known.
Let's see if we can get some people in here who do know something. Our callers are a very informed bunch. And we have Mary in Alameda on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mary.
Hi. I'm sorry, I can't tell if I'm on the air.
Yes, you are.
Yes.
I was calling in regards to what you were talking about earlier about drawing the lines, and I guess my comment's a little late for what you're talking about now. But
that's quite all right.
One of the places that you might want to talk about philosophically, and I'll take the comments off the air, are when the fetus or the thing, as you refer to it, no longer needs a host.
Mm-hmm. The point of viability.
Well, yeah, the
something like that
is no longer needed. Then, that might be a good time to draw the line. Up until that time, that line, who draws that line? Perhaps that's the discussion that you have about whether or not the host gets to draw the line.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when you're talking about, we do things to enhance the children, and is that right? I don't think genetic. I don't think that's scary. I think it gets a little bit dicey when you start trying to determine the sex of your child.
If we interfere too much with that, we may throw statistics off.
I don't know about that, but I know we already do interfere. I mean, the March of Dimes has pregnant women taking folic acid to promote the health. So, you know, where what are you talking about? Interference, interference good, interference bad, and who decides what's good?
Yeah,
and what's
yeah,
bad?
You've asked a lot of questions. Thanks very much for the call, Mary. Either of you gentlemen have any response?
The line she proposes about when the fetus no longer needs a host is pretty much what the Supreme Court did in Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. Let me just note, if we ever got to the point where you could maintain a fetus in an artificial womb, which right. is decades mm-hmm. away and may never come to pass, then I think we raise even more interesting philosophical questions. But right now, I think the Supreme Court's decision focuses on the rights of the woman, the rights of the person carrying the fetus, and those thus far, at least up to viability, trump the rights of the fetus.
I think that's a good point, and it's an interesting question. We do have to distinguish between a couple things. In the case of abortion, as a matter of circumstances, the woman's right not to have the baby inside and her right to have the life destroyed are pretty much the same. But if those were technically separable, I think we'd agree, well, no, the fact that you don't want the child inside of you doesn't mean you have a right to destroy the life. And then in the case of stem cell research, no other person acting as a host with her rights involved is part of the equation. Well, so they're kind of interestingly different questions.
And on your first point, we don't give fathers the right to decide to have an abortion because they don't want to be a father. So I think that supports your idea that if we could separate the life of the fetus from the mother's, from the pregnant woman's obligation to carry it, then we might get to a different state of law.
I take it that people who are worried about stem cell research and the morality of it aren't. I mean, it's related to the abortion issue, but it's different because
of the
point that John was making. I mean, some people just think it's a human life. It's the beginning of a human life, and therefore it's in some way inviolable or something. There's a pretty high bar that you have to cross to be able to
I think I think that in a lot of discussions, the term human life is used in a way that's kind of careless. I mean, the real question is whether it's a person. If it's alive and it's going to be a human eventually, then it's probably human life. But but philosophers who consider this usually think the real issue is whether it's a person. Then the question is, does that mean that some semi-mystical thing like a ensoulment has happened, or is it just a matter of the gradual, no line, able to draw ability to have all kinds of characteristically adult human functions.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking with Hank Greeley. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my colleague John Perry. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134, and we have a caller on the line, I think, who wants to talk about genetic engineering, Paula in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Paula.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm just wondering, you know, I have two children of my own, and one of them has some, we'll say slight learning disabilities and things like that, and we just sort of figured it was the luck of the draw. But I wanted to go more to the point of choosing even like sex or say you want a tall boy. You particularly think he might get a basketball scholarship or something. I'm wondering if that's another layer of responsibility that parents would maybe not want to invite on themselves because it may backfire. You may end up with a tall boy who is a bully and he's not at all interested in sports, and you have to go back to that very first genetic counseling session you had where you said, hey, honey, let's try to get a tall boy. And then now you've got this large boy who's broken the law and perhaps is causing your family lots of trouble. I mean, perhaps it's something we don't want to do for ourselves. We already have enough issues when children are chosen naturally with the sperm and the ovum.
Paula, I have to admit, thanks for the call, I have to admit I agree with you about 110%. Now, my perspective is, as a parent, but a long time since I've had any vague feeling of control over my children's lives, and now I've got 10 grandchildren, and I think that sure, you want to do what's right for your kids and give them the best opportunities, but I think there is a line to be drawn when you become a control freak, and it's usually counterproductive. And the idea of people being able to decide, you know, to put extra strong hamstrings in their kid because they want him to be a basketball star, it sends shivers up my spine.
Well, you know, something I think most people don't realize is that for almost 15 years now, parents who go through in vitro fertilization have been able to make choices about the genetic traits of their children. There's a process called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, where one cell from an eight-cell embryo is plucked out, genetically tested, and that you can then decide which embryos to implant based in part on the results. So, John, you don't want to have the responsibility for picking traits, but does that include avoiding implanting embryos that will have Tay-Sachs disease and inevitably die a horrible and young death?
No, I think this is like our earlier issue. It may be impossible to draw a line, but there is a line to be drawn on which, on the one side, are let's make intelligent decisions to not have children with incurable diseases or tremendous deficits, and let's let nature take its course and not let parents decide to micromanage the development of their children's genetics.
I think you're missing something, John. First of all, I think that line of thinking elevates the genes to something more powerful than they are. They're one causal determinant among others. You know, and the environment, we already said, plays a large role, and we manipulate the environment all the time. What are we doing when we feed our children good food? You know, when a woman takes care of herself in the womb, she's providing the best environment possible for her developing offspring. And if we can manipulate those causal factors without great moral fear, why I don't quite see what the real difference is between manipulating those and the genetics. Unless you think the genes play some really, really super duper special determining role, but they don't.
I turn that around and say, look at how little we know even about this thing we've been manipulating for eons, namely the environment, the educational environment. We still obviously don't do it right most of the time. Let's give ourselves a little time before we have to have a similar responsibility for the genetic environment.
Yeah, well, I have to side with Ken on this one. I think you're letting, again, the perfect be the enemy of the good. Yeah, it would be great if we understood everything perfectly, but we have to live our lives as moral actors and try to do the best for our kids based on what we know now. I would disagree with Ken, though, about the power of genes a little bit. Sometimes the environment's crucial and the genes are unimportant. There are no genes for learning Chinese rather than Gaelic rather than Navajo. Sometimes the genes are all-powerful and the environment's unimportant. You get the genes for Tay-Sachs disease, there's nothing we can do about it. For most of the things we care about, though, Ken's right, it's a mix of the two.
We have some callers waiting to get into this conversation. Clara in the East Bay. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Clara.
Hi.
Hi, Clara.
I want to go a different direction. I assume this is all going to be over time, and we'll keep ironing out these questions and things. The issue that I want to raise is a class issue. This is where my little class paranoia or whatever or not comes up, which is, you know, who it is. We already know who gets their braces, and, you know, it's the professional class and above, or people who are willing and understand to commit that to their children. And I can just see this divide that we have around class getting further and further entrenched, because now, of course, not only is it your teeth, it's going to be your eyes, your ears. I mean, you know, kids are already and have been since I was a kid doing nose surgery and whatever. You know, it's scary to me that we actually could clone at some point people who are going to be the quote-unquote menial workers. I mean, I can fantasize. I mean, maybe my little science fiction mind's going somewhere. But I think there's a concern here for me legitimately, and I'm a person who moved from poverty into middle class, and luckily I had decent teeth. But, you know, could I have been stopped from this because somebody else's middle-class parents or upper-middle-class professional-class parents did a little gene thing.
Yeah, you ask a good question. Thanks very much for the call, Clara. Hank, you wanted to respond.
Well, I think I've got some good news for you, Clara, at least right now, and I think for the foreseeable future. What we can do to help kids, to enhance kids genetically, is trivial compared to the power of environmental enhancements. If you could let me give kids any schooling you could desire, you can change their lives much more than you can from any gene manipulation we know right now, except avoiding serious genetic disease.
I understand what you're saying, and I agree. But let's let Clara's imagination run. Imagine a world in which we can do these things. It raises an important issue, right? We could do them in a very bad way, right? Or we could do them in a life-affirming way that spreads the goods of this stuff to all sorts of people. But that's a matter of what kind of social institutions we have, right? I mean, we shouldn't fear the science. We should take the relentless pressure that science is forcing on our current social institutions. We should respond to that pressure, I think, by improving our social institutions, by improving the way we distribute these possible goods and avoiding, the downside costs that might come with them. John, you want to read that?
Yeah, we've just got an email on this topic that I rather like. It's from Albert. And Albert says, the only reason I can think of why we shouldn't genetically engineer our children is that over a long period of time, hundreds of years, there won't be any room left for a rich and diverse society. Otherwise, we might end up with a world filled with rational, good-looking philosophers.
That would be fun.
Very good question. We're not even on television. How did he know?
Oh, that's a dystopia. I can't see us going there. Too many philosophers.
Yeah. Rational, good-looking lawyers?
Yeah, but...
sounds better.
But somehow, though, I mean, there's a serious question. I mean, why should we be trying to design our phenotype, as it were, and let nature take its course, I guess?
I don't want to argue that we should design it. I certainly don't want to argue, and I'd argue against the idea that government, insurance companies, or anybody else should design it. The question is whether you let parents make their own choices here. And I just note that the human species has been messing around with its genome at least as long as we've been civilized.
Yeah.
Everything we do in civilization changes which genes are more or less popular. Diabetics, juvenile onset diabetics, never had kids before insulin was available as a treatment. Now they've got kids, they pass on some genes at a higher rate that lead to the incidence of juvenile onset diabetes. That's not a bad thing.
Right.
We change our genomes constantly.
I agree with you. We're going to be going to a break in a little while. Just let me remind you, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Hank Greeley from Stanford University. I'm Ken Taylor, along with my colleague John Perry. You can join our conversation by calling 415-841-4134.
Yeah. We'll take a moment to consider these issues and return with the 60-second philosopher, Ian Scholes. Ian will look at a controversial forerunner to today's study of genetics, a pseudoscience known as eugenics.
There's more of Philosophy Talk after this short break.
There's a clone of a song we heard earlier, Thomas Dolby and She Blinded Me with Science. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We'll be getting back to our guest, Hank Greeley, and taking more calls from our listeners. That's you at 415-841-4134. But first, a regular feature in the program, the 60-Second Philosopher.
Each week, Ian Scholes examines a philosopher or philosophical movement and distills the essence of it into 60 seconds. Today, he will walk us through, or maybe run us through is a better way of putting it, the storied past of a movement known as eugenics. Prepare yourself. Ready? Go!
Ian Scholes, Charles Darwin put off writing The Origin of Species for close to 20 years, perhaps sensing it was a cultural bomb set to go off. The English philosopher Herbert Spencer had actually coined the phrase survival of the fittest several years before Darwin published Origin in 1859. Spencer projected his version of biological evolution on the social plane. As a baby becomes an adult, so a town evolves into a city. Others used Darwin's and Spencer's theories to create what came to be called social Darwinism, very popular in America. The fittest are rich white guys, of course. The poor, unevolved. A social Darwinist subset, eugenics, was dreamed up in 1883 by Francis Galton, one of those Victorian polymaths who seemed to do everything. He was an explorer, meteorologist, and the inventor of fingerprint identification. His eugenics was a moral philosophy. We should encourage the best and the brightest to have more children. Then eugenics migrated from England to the U.S. and Germany, and the darker flip side emerged. As the new century dawned, eugenics took a new science called genetics as its model. Genetics could explain all human social problems as just defective germplasm. If we want to breed thoroughbreds, after all, we've got to keep Seabiscuit away from the donkeys. Isn't it the same with people? The mentally ill, the halt, the lame, the retarded, the homeless, the degenerate? Put them in asylums. Or sterilize them, humanely. Intellectuals, the wealthy, doctors, sociologists, boards of experts, the fittest of the American fit, all jumped on the eugenics bandwagon. After all, medicine had advanced. It wasn't castration anymore. That would be cruel. Now we had vasectomies for the inferior fellas and tube tying for the inferior gals. Indiana passed the first Sterilization Act in 1907. By 1927, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes would rule, as part of the Supreme Court's decision on Buck v. Bell, that young Carrie Buck could be sterilized by the state of Virginia. He wrote famously, quote, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough," unquote. By 1935, some 20,000 forced sterilizations had been performed in the United States. By the 1940s, of course, as the world found out about Hitler's special spin on eugenics, it landed in the trash bin of history pretty fast. But in 1980, a researcher at the hospital where Carrie Buck had been sterilized found that more than 4,000 sterilizations had been performed there as late as 1972. He also found Carrie Buck, alive and well. Nobody had ever told her she'd been sterilized, and she was understandably bitter to discover the reason for her childishness. It was further determined that the best and the brightest who had declared her an imbecile in the 1920s were mistaken. She was of normal intelligence, as her mother had been before her. Why was she sterilized? Apparently because she was poor, black, and the illegitimate daughter of an illegitimate daughter. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher describing the brief history of eugenics. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Hank Greeley from Stanford University. So, Hank, look, the eugenics movement has a pretty ugly thing. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm pretty gung-ho about this stuff, as it should be clear. But I'm wondering, doesn't this whole Brave New World raise the specter of a neo-eugenics movement with all those dark sides?
We could go that way. We've got to be careful to make sure that we don't. I think the Nazis did us a favor in making eugenics a bad word for the foreseeable future in the West. Should note, though, that eugenics isn't a bad word in all of the world, and China in 1995 passed what their official translation called the Chinese Eugenics Law, requiring women to get tested before birth, and if the test showed a serious problem, to follow their doctor's advice, which everyone presumed meant to get an abortion.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. Oh, you know, but okay, so there's a dark side to this stuff, and there's a potential light side. But, you know, human institutions are pretty, unfortunately, mostly unreliable at guaranteeing that we'll get the good rather than the bad. I mean, wouldn't the safer route just be to say, you know, let's not go where we need not go? Why not? The morally safer route.
There are a lot of things we could pass up. All of civilization arguably should have been passed up. We should stay hunter-gatherers as the safer thing to do.
We've got you're talking.
Yeah, I'm not sure you would have done very well as survival of the fittest, John. I've seen you play tennis. But this is a science that does offer us great hope for improving the lives of people who are alive today, who will be alive soon. I think that has a lot of moral resonance. I think we've got an obligation to try to help people when we can. We equally have an obligation to try to minimize the harms of the new technology, to avoid its abuse. And frankly, thus far, in the last 20 years or so, when genetic science has really begun to be powerful scientifically, I think we've done a pretty good job of handling it in this country.
We've got a really pertinent caller here. Tim, I gather you're worried about Western medicine just going boldly forward without any moral reflection. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Tim. Are you there, Tim? We seem to have lost Tim. Thanks for calling.
Well, while we're at it, here's an email question, Ken. This is from Wayne, and Wayne says, I value my children's lives dearly and deeply. However, if they were not mine, I probably would not value them as much. If a stem cell has no one to love and no one to love it and take care of it, then maybe its only value is as raw material. What do you guys think of that?
You look puzzled.
That's a hard one to respond to, but let me use it to point out an important distinction we've ignored so far. A lot of the stem cell research that's been done thus far has been done with leftover embryos that were created for the purpose of in vitro fertilization in the hopes they'd be implanted and become kids, but never got implanted. That's one use. Another use, which you'd have to do if you went to cloned embryos, is making embryos specially, making a cloned embryo of John so he could grow a new kidney, a new bone marrow cells for him. To do that, we'd have to make an embryo expressly for the purpose of getting the stem cells, which means creating that embryo intending to destroy it. And that's a moral line that some people think is quite significant.
That's really using another person as a means, John.
Let's go. I want to go back
to using another something as a means. It's
another
using
something.
An embryo
right,
as
that's
a means.
A question.
Whether it's a person or not is the key issue.
It is a key issue. I want to go back to something Hank said that I think is rather interesting. That's about hunter-gatherers. There are theories of human nature that think we went off the rails at different point, most famously the Christian theory that says when Adam bit from the tree of knowledge. Most of these say, well, at some point, humans quit accepting the human condition, and that was a mistake. Now, I don't really believe that, but a little part of me thinks there's some wisdom there, and that's probably what bothers me about some of this stuff. It's just like when George Bush says, let's go to the moon. What? We're earthbound beings. Let's accept it and deal with it. And let's accept our diversity and the fact that not everybody gets to have great children, and not everybody gets to be as smart as Ken or as
handsome as you,
or as handsome as Hank.
But I don't know, John. I don't know. I have a fundamentally different take on this. I think of human history as relentless change. You know, I mean, the Romans and their empire aren't around anymore. Feudalism isn't around anymore. Human beings alter the world. That's what we do. You know, and we alter the world. Hopefully, we do it wisely and considerately.
Oh, give me
hopefully.
A break.
I mean,
give me a break.
Would you rather be alive now in a stable democratic society, or would you rather be an exploited laborer in the feudal, in some feudal emperor empire where you were malnourished?
He'd rather be emperor.
Yeah.
There's a. Why don't you ask? Would I rather be in some exploited part of the world that is exploited by this big democratic society, or be emperor of Rome?
That's another one.
I mean, the fact of the matter is that's a really poor way to answer the question. The fact is, we're in a world that's overpopulated, that's approaching ecological disaster because of the way we've changed it. Change is true.
But
is change always good? No, mostly it's been a mistake.
But we've
and
always
the fact
been
that
changing.
You'd rather be you than somebody 100 years ago or 1,000 years ago proves absolutely
nothing.
Nothing.
With all due respect, John, I think it's crazy to say that change has been a mistake. I mean, I'm happy that I live in a world. I'm happy that I live in a country at a time in a world when 30% of my kids didn't die before they were the age one, when my wife could expect to have 12 pregnancies if she survived them, most likely dying after 6 or 7, when my life expectancy would be 40. And I think I agree with Ken. The human project has been one of transforming itself and transforming nature, I don't see any end to that.
There are 6 billion people in this overcrowded world. You guys sound a little to me like the guy that jumped off the 100-story building, and as he went past the 20th story, said, "Wow, this is so much fun."
No, there's nothing.
Who thought this was a bad idea?
I don't think either of us is saying that the population has to grow continually, and I personally think smaller population is a good thing, and our technology doesn't necessarily mean that there will be huge population increases.
Yeah, I just think, I agree. You talked about the National Institutes of Health being the bureau for raising moral issues that we haven't the means to solve or something like that, and you'd rather rename it. And I understand that, but I want to reiterate, I think, again, you know, the benefits of science are not just in don't just follow from the intrinsic character of science. They don't just flow directly. They're kind of mediated by the social institutions that we have, and we have to perfect, along with trying to perfect ourselves, we have to perfect our social institutions. And that's a challenge, sure, but why should we shirk from that challenge? A world in which, you know...
and let's be in favor of motherhood while we're at it, too, Ken. I mean, our social institutions are far from being perfect. We do the best we can with them. But typically, the biggest problems with human society have come when our ability to change things has outstripped our ability to know what it is we're changing. When we can launch guided missiles on people we can't see and we can't see the effects of it, that's when bad things really happen. So let's have a little humility. And besides that, I think you guys both missed out on the grouch gene.
Yeah, well, I think that's right.
You've got two copies there, John.
Thanks a lot, Hank.
Hank, it's been really a pleasure having you on Philosophy Talk. I'll give you one last word if you have a quick one.
This is an amazing science. I do think we should all learn more about it and learn more about how it fits in our society, because I do think we all should feel a duty to try to maximize its benefits and minimize its harms.
Thanks for those words of wisdom.
Thanks a lot, Ken. It's been great talking with you.
No, Hank, I'm Ken.
but I'm I've been talking.
Okay. So, John, are you besides being confused, are you wiser today? I mean,
oh, it's always fun to talk philosophy, and you advocate certain points, but as a philosopher, you're kind of a little bit like a lawyer. I mean, lawyers represent people, and philosophers represent ideas, and you do the best you can with them. I think we know a lot. I think Socrates says that if he was wiser than everyone else in Athens, it was because how little he thought he knew.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way humans ought to feel about the power that's being put in their hands.
Okay, I'll give you the last word there, even though I'm more optimistic than you are about our ability to deal with these things.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started into hum. Well, it's a real good bet the best is yet to come.
Hey, John.
What's that drumming?
That's not drumming, Ken. That's conundrumming.
Conundrumming, that's when the caller calls with a big puzzle or devils their mind and we confuse them even more, right?
Yeah, and sometimes it's timely. Like with Ralph Nader in the race, we've got a hot political conundrum today.
Hello, Forrest. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hello.
Where are you calling from, Forrest?
From Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon. What a beautiful spot. Is it raining there today?
It is raining.
Why am I not surprised?
So, Forrest, what's your conundrum?
Well, if I don't vote for one of the leading contenders, am I wasting my vote? This was a big question in the 2000 presidential election. It might come up again in this presidential election.
So you were one of those people who was tempted or maybe did vote for Ralph Nader and you wondered whether...
I did vote for Ralph Nader.
And you wonder whether you threw your vote away?
Well, I don't feel like I did. Here in Oregon, you know, Gore won, for example, and so here we weren't accused of anything, but in Florida, I know the Nader voters were heavily accused.
You know, voting is an area in which thinking philosophically can sometimes be delicate. If you say the truth, it can have bad effects.
What do you mean by that, John?
Well, I mean, your vote doesn't make any difference. If your family is voting on something or if your business group is voting on something and there's 10 or 12 or 15 or 20 people, it's quite conceivable your vote's going to make a difference. But voting in big elections is the kind of thing where everybody has to do their share or it won't work, except not everybody has to do their share. Only most people have to do their share. So we vote with the idea that we're doing our share for democracy. But if we think about the particular effect of our one vote, only in extraordinary circumstances is it going to make a difference in those situations.
Well, if everybody thought that way, thinking that their vote didn't count, we'd be in bad shape.
Yeah, well, that's... You're right, Forrest, that if everybody had the principle, well, my vote's not going to make a difference, and everybody acted on that, then that would be a bad thing. And you might think, well, the Kantian in me says, you know, only act on principles that could be universal principles. You
What's a Kantian? Who's Kant?
You know, that's one of those old dead guys that inspires me daily.
Immanuel Kant.
Immanuel Kant.
The great German philosopher of the couple centuries
back. But, you know, there's another thing about voting your conscience, voting for Nader. I think it's an important thing because we're in this crazy electoral system in which your choices are so minimal, right? In other systems, not so much for the presidency, but if you were in a parliamentary system, you know, you could vote your choice, vote your real preference, and if everybody else voted their real preference, you'd get some representation for the Green Party in the Congress or something like that. And, you know, we're in this winner-take-all, narrow-choice thing. It's a bad thing, I think. So you might think your vote is a protest against an inadequate electoral system. So that would give you a principle right there for voting your conscience.
By voting for Nader, you give yourself the right to say truthfully, I voted for Nader. And that's something that, you know, you say, I voted for Gore, I voted for Bush. Nobody really cares. You say, I voted for Nader. They say, well, now, why did you do that? That's an unusual thing to do, get conversation started. So you might have a lot of good reasons for voting for Nader.
Well, thank you for answering my question or entertaining it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And whether you plan on voting Democrat, Green, Libertarian, Peace and Freedom, did I leave somebody out?
Republican.
Oh, yeah.
Just head to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the button on the top right called Conundrums. That's www.philosophytalk.org. And the harder the conundrum, the better. I like to see my partner squirm.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2004. Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, Alan Farley, and the members of KALW Information Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institute, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
The views expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University, our funders, or anyone else for that matter.
Particularly no one in their right mind. Our discussion continues online at www.philosophytalk.org. philosophytalk.org. And I want to encourage you to go to that website. There's ongoing conversations. You, Ken and I occasionally weigh in. We've got students from Stanford to do. My son gets on there every so often. A lot of interesting discussions. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Next week, we'll look at markets and morality. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.